Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, very pleased today to be joined by Nalini Nadkarni, who's Professor Emeritus at University of Utah and Evergreen State College, Senior Research Fellow at Sorenson Impact Institute, National Geographic Explorer at Large, author of Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees, also Tree Notes, A Year in the Company of Trees, which is in turn based on her podcast, Tree Note, for KUER. So a lot going on there, and we're very pleased to be talking to Nalini Nadkarni today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm delighted to be here.
So I want to read just a couple of sentences from a couple of biographies. First, I think it's from National Geographic. Throughout human history, trees have provided our most important sources of sustenance, protection, and wonder. Nalini Nadkarni, a tree canopy ecologist, has spent four decades dangling among the branches to study how forests inform our daily lives. A lifelong interest and concern for trees, Ned led Nalini to an academic career to study and understand trees and innovate activities and programs that raise awareness of the importance of trees and nature to others. That last is from your website, nalini.nadkarni.com.
Right.
So I definitely want to talk about climbing trees and the kind of the fun part, I assume, of your science, right? Up in that canopy. But how did this start? How did you get interested in trees and ecology?
Well, you know, I think as with many scientists, that sort of passion about a particular interaction or organism or ecosystem happens when they're very young. And that was definitely true for me. I grew up in Bethesda, Maryland. My parents had these 8 maple trees that lined the driveways. And I was a kid who loved to climb trees. And I had 4 brothers and sisters and parents and pets and homework and chores. And so being able to climb trees after school was kind of finding my place, my little quiet refuge where I could be undisturbed, read a book, eat an apple, watch those squirrels going from one crown to another. And I really felt like that was my place. And so I remember taking a little oath when I was just 8 or 9 years old saying, when I'm a grown-up, I'm going to do something good for trees. I want to protect them. I want to understand them. And I had no idea what I would do, maybe be a forest ranger or a firefighter. But I ended up finding the pathway of learning and understanding, learning about and understanding trees. And that led me to my academic career of being a forest ecologist, studying the forest canopies, and trying to communicate what I've been fortunate enough to learn about canopies and rainforests to others.
I want to read from your bio at University of Utah in this case. Professor Nadkarni's interest was first drawn to rainforest ecology due to the contradiction offered by its plant life. Goes on to talk about how a lot of rainforests have nutrient poor soil, but an overabundance of plant life. So tell me about that contradiction.
Yeah, that is a contradiction that I guess scientists have been aware of that since the early 1980s. When we were sort of surprised by finding that many of these extremely tall, high biomass, luxurious, and very diverse forests are living on soils that are extremely poor in nutrients. They've been leached out over the centuries, over the millennia of their nutrients. And so a puzzle that many rainforest scientists have spent their careers, as I have, trying to understand is how do we resolve this paradox of abundance and luxuriance of growth with what seem to be very poor resources.
So part of this, I'm just reading here, I didn't know this, I'm sure you know about this, aerial roots.
Yes.
So roots that grow up, not down.
Yeah, so that was actually it solves one of those questions that I just raised about how the heck does a forest flourish in a place where there's very little nutrients in the way of soil availability. And when I was a graduate student at the University of Washington and just starting out doing my studies in forest canopy biology, I was just doing some very basic, almost what you'd call maybe 19th century research, just documenting what was up there in the forest canopy. The plants that live up there are called epiphytes, plants that get support but not nutrients from their host trees. They don't have roots that go into the tree or down to the forest floor, but rather they get their nutrients from rain, dissolved in rain and mist and fog. And they create these mats of mosses and other plant life that then creates sort of a soil, what we call a canopy soil, underneath them, perched on the branches and trunks of the host trees. And when I began just doing some very elementary work of cutting these mats of epiphytes and their canopy soils off, I began noticing that there were roots that were running up and down the trunks and branches of these trees. When I traced them back to their origin, it turns out that they originated in the trunks and branches of the host trees themselves, snaking underneath these mats of canopy soil and actually absorbing nutrients from the very plants that they were supporting. So it was sort of a shortcut in nutrient cycles. That is, the trees that support these canopy-dwelling plants and their soils are actually gaining a nutrient benefit directly from those plants that they support. Sort of like paying rent to the landlord, you know, that it was a kind of a synergistic interaction rather than a competitive or even neutral interaction.
I want to return talking about science, but I'm fascinated by the mechanics of this. So you ended up with a career in climbing trees.
I did.
So you have to get up to the canopy.
Yes,
tell me about that. How do you climb these trees?
That's a great question, Tom, because one of the reasons why the canopy was so poorly known just 40 years ago, it was called the last biotic frontier. That's how poorly known it was scientifically, was because of the lack of safe and non-destructive access to the canopy. But about 40 years ago, just as I was a graduate student and being curious about, like, what am I going to contribute to science? There were a few pioneering people who started applying mountain climbing techniques to get up to the tops of tall trees using the gear, the equipment, the techniques that that rock climbers do. And so I learned from a guy named Don Perry, who was an initial pioneer of canopy exploration. He used a crossbow to shoot a fishing line up and over a branch high in the canopy. That would come down. We would tie a little nylon cord to the end of that fishing line, pull that line up, and then tie a regular climbing rope, like what you'd buy at REI to climb rocks, up and over the branch, tie one end of that rope off to the tree, and then putting on a harness and just standard ascending devices, be able to inchworm your way up the tree to the top of the canopy. And so that's really the major way that I've been getting up into the forest canopy. It's very safe. It doesn't hurt the tree. Basically, you're not putting spikes in the tree like pole, you know, like telephone pole climbers do. So it's a fabulous way to, and an inexpensive way, a non-destructive way of exploring this last biotic frontier.
I guess a couple just things technical before we get back to science. I was reading, I think I found this on your website, again, alininudkarni.com. There's a publication, the publication Grist, and you had kind of a daily journal of activities for a while. This was 20 years ago, but you were at that point proposing to bring new eyes, you said, to the canopy. So small groups of observers, culturally societal inexperienced with trees and forests. So Inuits from Alaska were born and raised in treeless tundra, Paiute Indians from Arizona desert, urban youth from Seattle to Tacoma. Did you end up doing that?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I got a grant from the National Geographic Society, actually, to perform what I called a new kind of conservation. That is, instead of bringing together experts the way people in academia do, we rely on people who know similar things than we do, use similar vocabulary, have similar backgrounds. I thought, what if we brought people who had never seen trees or really weren't acquainted with trees or maybe didn't have a positive feeling about trees the way most forest ecologists do? What if we brought them to the canopy, and what would their perceptions be, and how would they communicate their perceptions of the forest canopy? So I carried out a series of what I call canopy confluences. A confluence means to flow together, like two river systems coming together, not to dilute any of the disciplines that were represented, but instead to get fresh eyes on a system, a subsystem of forest that I'm very familiar with, that is the forest canopy. So we invited visual artists, we invited slam poets, we invited modern dancers, we invited school teachers, we invited loggers. We would spend a whole week in a remote area of primary forest, both in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State and down in Costa Rica, and my study sites there. And we had platforms that we installed sort of 100 feet above the forest floor. And we taught them each how to climb using the climbing techniques that I just described. And we just let them sit up there on those platforms and take in what they were seeing, what they were hearing, what they were smelling, and then ask that they create whatever they wished in terms of what their perceptions were and how they would want to communicate it to their audiences. So our modern dancer created this amazing dance called Biome about the rainforest canopy in Costa Rica. We had several art exhibits. We had poetry readings. But I think what was most fascinating was when we had a session where we invited people who had never, literally never seen forests. So we invited a number of people who are blind and also two Inuits from the Northern Territories of Nunavut in Northern Canada who live in and have grown up in the tundra and who literally had not seen trees before. In fact, when we picked them up at the airport and we said, so how many words for snow do you have? Because, you know, that's always the sort of joke about how many, how well they perceive subtle differences in snow type. And they said, oh, well, we have, you know, 25 different words came out. But when we asked them what they, how they call trees in their language of Inuktitut, they said, well, Nabaktuk is the word for tree, which means pole. And Nabaktuk Juit means many poles. And so we thought, well, clearly there's no linguistic or cultural connection, you know, for these this group of people with trees. But, you know, after a week of climbing trees, of camping out underneath cedar trees and hemlock trees, and hearing all the other people in the confluence who were there, who were experiencing and taking in forests, the last day when we were sitting around the campfire, we asked Brian and Emil, the two men from the Inuits. One of them was an artist and had drawn an image. And the trees in it were definitely pole-like. They were long and skinny. But in front of it, there was this picture of a stone cairn, this stack of rocks. And it was completely aligned with a tree behind it. And we said, well, so what does that mean? He said, well, in the tundra, we don't have trees to mark our ways. We use these cairns. We use these stacks of stones to guide us. And he said, in the week that I've been here, I've come to understand that trees are your guideposts and that you should treat them with the same respect that we treat our elders in our village of Arviat. You know, and so that statement coming from Brian, who until a week before had never encountered a tree at all, to come to understand this very elementary idea of how trees are important to us, how they can guide us, how we must be guided by them, to me was one of the most important conservation statements that I've ever heard in my 42-year-old career of working with trees. And so I think it speaks to the universal power, the universal affinity that we have with trees, that even people who don't grow up with them can also sense that when they're exposed to them.
Many of us listening, myself included, haven't been in the canopy. So I'm just wondering, what's it like? What's it like out there, up there? What do you see?
I wish I could take you, Tom, and every one of your listeners here in Utah up to the top of a canopy. And so basically, you know, if we walk from a field station in the tropics, for example, in Costa Rica, where I do most of my work, along the, you know, in the forest floor, you would sense it was sort of dark and cool and shaded with all the branches that are over your head, and there's not much wind at all. But once I put you in your harness and taught you how to climb up that rope, what you would feel and see as you ascended into the treetops is a really dramatic change in the microclimate. There's suddenly, when you're in the canopy, you're exposed to much more sunlight, much greater extremes of relative humidity and temperature. There's a lot more wind up there. It's like being in the atmosphere of an open field. And then all around you are these branches that go out horizontally forever that are just covered with mosses and orchids and bromeliads and ferns. And, you know, birds are suddenly at your level. You know, you see a hummingbird coming by your head. It's not over your head. It's like right where you are, you know, and spider monkeys might be coming right into the crown of your tree that you can, and you can see them close up. So it's also an opportunity when you're sitting in the canopy to see the individuality of each of the tree crowns, that each of those is moving, is shifting in the wind independently. Everything is three-dimensional. It's not two-dimensional like a picture of a forest. And instead of just seeing the sort of boring vertical lines of tree trunks, you're surrounded by this complex three-dimensional array of branches. And so it's a feeling of wonder, of awe, and I feel a sense of interconnection. I feel never more connected with life on earth than when I'm in the canopy, because I can literally see and smell and hear and feel nature around me sort of in stereo. And that's why I wish I could bring you and all your listeners up there.
Yeah, that would be amazing. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking today with tree ecologist Nalini Nadkarni. She's professor emeritus at University of Utah and Evergreen State College, author of Tree Notes, A Year in the Company of Trees, which is based on her popular Tree Note podcast, which you can catch over at KUER and wherever you get your podcasts. Later in the program, we'll get talking about the Tree Notes podcast, such questions as how many kinds of trees are there, trees and lightning, conductor's batons, the things we turn trees into, the space between trees. So a lot of questions there. We'll be talking later in this conversation about tree ecology and what rainforests mean to the planet. But right now, a reminder that we are in our UPR Spring Fund Drive, and I'm joined by Katie Swain.
Good morning, Tom. It's really good to be here with you and hearing these wonderful tree stories from Nalini.
It is just a pleasure. She hinted that she'd like to come back on the program at some point, so we'll definitely do that. But in the meantime, enjoying this conversation right now.
Certainly, and a great reminder, Tom, that conversations like this on Access Utah are made possible by listener support, which is what we do here. Remind you of that during our fund drives. You can help support Access Utah interviews like the one we have for you today by going online to upr.org or calling us 800-826-1495 and making a donation in support of it. The amount is up to you, but every amount helps. And, you know, Tom, very appropriately, we actually have a tree-themed thank you gift that would fit in really well for those listening now.
We do. So for a contribution of $20 a month or more, you can choose our good gift for good incentive option. You can have trees planted in the Amazon rainforest in your honor through a verified reforestation project using native species. So this is really fun. I think 5 trees will be planted in your name. You'll receive GPS coordinates and a tracking link, so you can follow your trees over time. So what a wonderful thing. See those trees grow. And, you know, 5 trees isn't going to change the world. But if all of us, many of us do that, that's going to really help to reforest those parts of the Amazon that need it.
And in many ways, it's much like public media membership, Tom. You know, maybe your $5 a month or $10 a month, that's not going to fund this station in itself. But when we all work together, you know, 5 becomes many, many, many more than that. And we're able to do very powerful things like Utah Public Radio, a statewide service, and hopefully make a big impact on the reforestation efforts of the Amazon rainforest. That's your donation this morning of $20 a month, actually available all week long. If you go to our upr.org donate page, click that green button, and then select $20 a month, select our gift for good incentive option, and that's how you can select that. Another great reason to give, though, right now, Tom, we actually have a dollar-for-dollar match, which is very exciting. For Access Utah, this hour only, we're looking to match $500.
So, yes, upr.org. This is Leslie and Jay Black who've put up that $500, and I appreciate this. This is for Access Utah. So we'd love to see this all gone during this hour. They're putting up a matching dollar-for-dollar fund. So you give $10, it's doubled to $20. You give $100, doubled to $200. Just that simple. And, of course, that money comes to Utah Public Radio to help support programs like Access Utah.
The match happens automatically when you give right now. Again, upr.org. Simple process. Take a couple of minutes right now before we return to this great conversation with Nalini Nadkarni, and make your donation in any amount. It's matched by Leslie and Jay Black up to $500 this hour only. So please do make your gift known and your support. Maybe leave a comment about what you enjoy about UPR or Access Utah. Again, all that happens at upr.org.
or what you'd like to hear. Love to talk about what you'd like to have me talk about on the program. We think about a recent program that was a big hit. My conversation with Terry Tempest Williams, her new book, The Glorianas. But other programs very recently, we had the Valentine Day King on. That was a lot of fun.
I love that one, Tom.
This is a guy who every Valentine's Day does something big for his wife, and this year it was in Logan. A partnership with Bluebird Chocolate. We've had dementia awareness, prevention, folklore, of course, always. And children's books by Cache Valley authors. That was a very recent program that really enjoyed. If you're enjoying these programs, we would like to have your support to pay for the programs. And a couple of big incentives. Your dollar is matched, dollar filler matched today. And love to have you coming in at $20 per month. You can get that gift for good. Trees planted in your name in the Amazon rainforest.
UPR.org, easy to do there. And thank you so much for joining us and listening today.
On the next Radiolab,
we have a pretty happy little planet to live on.
Scientists say Earth can sustain life for another 100 million years.
What things are we going to run out of?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oil. Copper, sand, lithium.
That is nuts.
But what if there was a way to stop it?
It's like a car about to collide into a cliff and then whoop, swerves out of the way.
That's on the next Radiolab
during our Spring Fund Drive here at Utah Public Radio, Tuesday at 10.
Utah Public Radio is now completely supported by our listeners and our content sponsors. Our audience knows that the businesses who sponsor programs on our statewide network are also supporting UPR. Your business could be aligned with the programs that you love, including Wild About Utah, Behind the Headlines, Access Utah, and Marketplace. Marketing your business on UPR can help attract qualified employees and new customers. For more information, email debbie.andrew@usu.edu.
We are listening to this interview I recorded last week with Nalini Ned Carney, who's Professor Emeritus at University of Utah and Evergreen State College. She's National Geographic Explorer at Large and author of Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees. Also, Tree Notes, A Year in the Company of Trees, which is based on our popular Tree Note podcast. I want to kind of go broader. What does, I guess, the rainforest in specific and, I guess, trees in general, what does that do for Earth? What does that do for the overall ecology of Earth?
Well, trees are plants, of course, and they have evolved this remarkable process of photosynthesis. So one of the major things they do in terms of us as humans and every other animal and mammal is produce oxygen. So they take in carbon dioxide and they exude oxygen. And they don't do this out of the goodness of their non-existent hearts. They do that because that's how they garner energy. They take energy from the sun and they do this amazing conversion that, as it turns out, is the exact complement of what we do, which is to breathe out carbon dioxide and bring in oxygen. They also, from the human standpoint, provide food in terms of fruits and nuts. They provide materials for building our structures, timber, lumber for our homes. They also, I think I could say, trees inspire a sense of spirituality, and that's manifested, I think, by the many, many religious symbols that contain trees for the world religions. The tree of life, you know, right there on the first page of our Old Testament, the tree with the white fruits in the Book of Mormon. And there are many analogs in Hinduism and in Judaism and in Islam, where trees are portrayed, are described as being positive, as being important, not only symbolically, but in a practical way. And so I think that they have become, for humans, these very, very important spiritual symbols. And finally, I think they, aesthetically, they provide beauty for our eyes and our spirits. And I think that's one of the most important features. Although I'm a scientist, I'm also very sensitive to aesthetics and love art and music. And so when I think of the number of paintings and poetry and dance performances and music, you know, the Symphony Pastoral is all about nature and trees and storms coming and abating. And so I think trees really have contributed to our sense of beauty on this planet?
Rainforests, some rainforests at least, are under threat.
Yes.
What do we lose when we lose at least part of a rainforest?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Tom, that really, I guess, again, in the 1980s, we began realizing that human activities like forestry, logging, conversion of primary forests to agricultural use of land, changing primary forests to pastures to grow cattle, more people just moving in on land that used to be forest, invasive species, and certainly climate change are having really extreme negative effects on forest ecosystems. And so that's one of the things that I think that has really precipitated and generated a lot of work, a lot of concern, a lot of motivation for many scientists to do research, but also to communicate what's going on in forests in general on our planet, and more specifically in the tropics. And so when we lose forests, we lose the capacity of forests to sort of gather and hold on to nutrients and water in rain that's delivered in rain and mist, as I was describing before. Trees are incredibly important in terms of retaining soil. In urban areas, yeah, this isn't just wildland areas, but in urban areas, urban tree cover is very important in terms of reducing what we call the urban heat island effect, where when you reduce tree cover, you also reduce the capacity of trees to transpire water and to provide shade within urban ecosystems. And so all of those things combined are really, I think, diminishing the quality of human life and animal diversity, as well as all of these other sort of intangible values that I spoke of in terms of spirituality and aesthetics.
What is climate change doing to forests?
That's a really complex question. In some cases, studies are showing us that the increase in temperatures is actually increasing the productivity of forests. That is, making them grow faster, making them grow better. And so especially young forests, for instance, in New England, we're seeing much more forest cover and much more rapidly growing trees than what we had seen before. But in other cases, especially tropical rainforests that are not adapted to temperatures that are much higher or to the longer dry seasons that we're encountering in many tropical regions, we're seeing declines in forest productivity and in tree diversity. So it's something that can be argued both ways, but I think that all of us scientists are aware that this is going on and that we need to pay attention in terms of our own research and our own reporting of what's going on with forests during climate change. Mm. The work that I'm doing in the tropical montane cloud forests of Costa Rica, it's very much a negative effect. What we're seeing there is a forest that's adapted to having very common exposure to mist and cloud, driven by the trade winds that sort of bathe that cloud forest in mist and fog. And that's really important for those epiphytic plants that I was talking about. We're seeing now longer and longer durations of dry seasons. So there are more and more days where there's no mist and fog, and that is having a negative effect on them. And trees are sort of, they respond in slow motion. You know, they're not rapid the way many animal species move from one place to another in response to climate change. So trees are kind of responding in this very slow motion way, but those changes are now being documented as happening.
I want to talk a bit about your research, but I guess as a foundation for that, I think maybe I'm a stand-in for many of our audience members in not understanding really how a rainforest works. Could you give us kind of the mechanics of how a rainforest works?
Well, rainforests work sort of like every other forest in that we can look at the structure of the forest, the biomass of it, that is that there's blobs of carbon and nitrogen and other nutrients that are sort of there as the buildings of the forest. And then we also want to look at what goes on in terms of fluxes. Where do nutrients, for example, where do they come in? They're absorbed from the soil. They come in from rainfall and mist and fog. And they're held within that biomass of the forest for some period of time. The nutrients are cycled pretty quickly with litter fall when trees lose their leaves and they decompose and they're taken up by trees. Sometimes rainfall can leach nutrients out from leaves and bring them to the forest floor. Root connections can connect trees as well as trees with shrubs, trees with microorganisms. And so a primary forest works like sort of like a city. You know, there are structures there and there are fluxes from one building and one part of a city to another. And a problem can happen, or problems can happen, when there's something that disturbs either the pools of materials that are there in the buildings or the fluxes, the movements from one to another. You can think of a traffic jam in New York City. If you get a problem, if you get a disturbance that causes a traffic jam, you're not going to get the flow of trucks and cars that keep that city vibrant and flourishing. And the same thing happens with tropical rainforests, is that if you get a big windstorm that comes through and knocks down all those structures, you're going to get an interruption or a disturbance of the nutrients and energy that were stored in those living things. If you get more rainfall than expected, you might get more leaching, more movement out of the leaves than what that forest has evolved to accommodate. And so you get a change in the flux of movement from the canopy to the forest floor. And there are many questions remain about how rainforests work at their most basic level that scientists just don't know yet. So my hope is that, you know, the next generation of biology students or chemistry students or ecological students will take on understanding forests so that we can answer some of those remaining questions.
Tell me about, let's dive a little deeper into your research. Tell me a little bit more about your research.
Sure. I'd love to talk. Every scientist loves to talk about her research. You know, on my research way back 40 years ago when I was starting out canopy research as a graduate student, it was purely descriptive, purely observational. It was like, what the heck is up there? You know, like, what's the biomass of those mosses and where are they distributed in the tree kind? It was like, you know, being a 19th century botanist, basically. It was not fancy. It wasn't experiments. It wasn't modeling. It wasn't using fancy tools. It was very, very basic. But over the decades of myself and many other canopy scientists contributing to the basic understanding of forest canopies, our work has become more sophisticated. And so now we're doing experiments to find out what are the processes that might be disturbed, for example, if we get climate change happening. And actually, this most recent project that I'm working on now with three other scientists, it is funded by the National Science Foundation, is asking the question, what is the effect of climate change on these canopy-dwelling plants and on the trees that support them? As we're getting these longer dry seasons, as I mentioned before, as we're getting less mist and fog upon which these plants depend, how is that going to affect them? Are they going to be able to adapt quickly to it? Are they resilient to this disturbance of climate change? We don't really know what the answer is yet. And we're just now in year two of our study. So if you invite me back to this radio program in another couple of years, I'll be able to have some answers for you. We can do some observational, you know, we can say, oh my God, these ferns are looking so dry. I've never seen them so dry when I climb up into these trees. But now what we're trying to do is quantify that. We're using sensors, we're using data loggers, we're using remote sensing, we're using drones now to fly over tree crowns so that we can scale up from single trees and our measurements of single trees to a whole landscape level. And we're asking questions not only about forest-dwelling trees, but also about trees that have been left in pastures. So we're really also trying to take into account the effects of changes in land use, that is farming and pasture making, and how that compares to what's going on in a primary undisturbed forest.
I want to get on to Tree Note and Tree Notes, the podcast, the book. But before we do that, there was, I think it was an episode of Tree Note, you talked about seeing the trees in your local area. And you, I think this particular episode talked about a tree walk. You know, you go walk through the trees at the University of Utah. But I'm imagining, yes. What would your suggestion be? I guess just get out among the trees?
I'm glad you brought that up. Absolutely. The whole purpose of Tree Note, which I think we'll talk about, is to raise awareness of the beauty and the importance and the wonder of trees that are not just in faraway places like Costa Rica and Bhutan and the Congo and the Amazon, but the wonder and beauty and importance of trees right here in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our suburban areas, and all around us. And I think that sometimes we overlook that. And I think that's partly because, you know, trees are quiet. They don't speak for themselves. They're rooted in one place. They don't seem to behave. They're not like lions and cheetahs and giraffes, you know, which people get all excited about them when they watch documentary films. And so I feel like a challenge for someone like me who's trying to always promote the idea that trees are significant and worthy of protection is to reveal somehow the wonder of trees, even though they might look kind of boring and dumb and can't really express how amazing they are. And so part of that is just paying attention to the trees that are literally in your neighborhood. And I'll just put a pitch from University of Utah, which is we have a wonderful tree tour that's available that the facilities people put together. This was not the ecologists. They were consulted, but it was the facilities people who did this. And they made a wonderful online tree tour of about 90 trees right on our campus, where you can go up to a tree. It has the a little plaque on it with the common name and the scientific name. And then you can click on your phone, and it will give you information about the biology of that tree, the seasonality of its fruiting and flowering, and its horticulture, how you can grow a tree and make that tree flourish, should you choose to grow that species. And so it really gives you this wonderful, I don't know, it's like a portrait gallery, you know, like it's like you're going to an art gallery, and instead of just looking at these pictures on the walls, you know, there's a guide with you who's actually telling you about the significance of the history of that piece of art and who painted it and why it's intriguing to us and how it advanced that school of art. And so I think a tree tour like that is really important. But I also think that it's important to not need a guide. Trees don't need a guide. You can just use your own eyes to marvel at them. And actually, one of the Tree Note episodes I did was about the body language of trees. The body language of trees. Isn't that beautiful?
That is beautiful.
There was a German arborist. His name was Klaus Matthek, and he wrote a book called The Body Language of Trees. And basically he said that trees grow in a way that they freeze and they record the way they grow, but also whatever traumas they have sustained. So if there was a windstorm and a branch came off, you'll see that little stub of a branch and you'll say, oh, there was a branch there and now it's just a stub. And how did the rest of the branches compensate for that extra sunlight? So you'll say, oh, that's right. The upper branch has grown from way over to the side of it and has now taken over that space. And so you literally can walk down the street looking at each tree and reconstructing the traumas and the life history of that individual. And I think that is really cool.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with tree canopy ecologist Lenine Nadkarni. She's Professor Emeritus both at Utah University of Utah and Evergreen State College. And tree expert, National Geographic describes her as having spent 4 decades dangling among the branches to study how forests inform our daily lives. And we're pleased to present this conversation for you today on Access Utah. Coming up, our final segment with Nalini Nadkarni. First, to let you know, we're in the middle of our UPR Spring Fund Drive. And I'm Tom Williams, joined by Katie Swain.
Good to be with you, Tom, and really enjoying this interview, I think, with many of you listening as well. I loved what Nalini said about kind of enjoying local trees, the trees that are around you, Tom. It really reminds me a lot about UPR's service, this and the local journalism. You know, of course, there are wonderful national programs that we also air here on UPR, but the local programs are what are the most unique offering that we have, and what make us the most connected to all of you, to this community. And that is something that is really worth appreciating and supporting, which is what our fund drives are all about. If you can afford to make a donation in support of local conversations, local journalism, local news, and just appreciating, you know, the things that are happening within our own communities and neighborhoods, then please do make a gift in the amount that works for your budget. UPR.org is where you can go to do that. You know, we'll take a look at when these calls and donations come in, Tom, as you know, and those matter a lot as we look at programming changes or potential changes, that is. And, you know, so this is your pledge of support for Access Utah, as well as all the other things that you enjoy.
And I look at those not only as program director, but especially for Access Utah, as you could imagine, you know, with kind of some personal interest because it's my show.
Of course.
And I want it to be of interest. I do get that anecdotally. People tell me that they're enjoying the program, but this is really where the rubber meets the road. How many calls are coming in, how much money is coming in to support the program. That's really, really the vote of confidence. And so we hope that you'll go right now to upr.org, click on the green donate button and donate what you can. UPR.org, or consider maybe increasing that just a little bit here in the wake of the loss of federal funds. Perhaps you could, you've been inching closer to the producer circle level, and that would be great if you'd make that step into the producer circle.
That's a gift of $100 a month or $1,200 over the course of a year. You know, you can make that one time or however it works for you. But yes, we would love to welcome you into the producer circle. A really powerful way to support UPR and you join a group of people who are just really at the forefront of local public media and powering UPR.
I want to read this as a message we got just this hour from Leslie Black. She says, what a wonderful program today about trees. The conversation is so informative and great storytelling there. That's what I love about Access Utah, the way you invite and direct the conversations with all sorts of interesting people. I always learn something new and will think about these things all day. I love hearing that from Leslie and Jay, they're thinking about that all day. I love so many programs at UPR. Morning Edition starts my day, and throughout the day, I love the stories, the investigative journalism, the music, TED Talks, Reveal, BBC, The Moth, This American Life, All Things Considered. I just love UPR. Such an important part of my life every day. Jay and I are happy to support UPR and invite others to join us in the giving of what you can. Thanks. That's Leslie Black. So appreciate that message.
Certainly. Thank you, Leslie. And another thank you, of course, to Leslie and Jay, Tom, because this hour they are matching your donations. This is dollar for dollar. You give and automatically it's doubled thanks to this match by Leslie and Jay Black, up to $500. Go online to upr.org, make your gift in the amount that works for you. And again, that is an automatic way to have it doubled and really increase your impact for Utah Public Radio.
We appreciate that that challenge. And so take Leslie and Jay Black up on that. Your gift in any amount is doubled this hour. Also, I guess one more thing here. Thank you, gift. Very unique for this fund drive. Your contribution of $20 a month or more, you can choose the gift for good incentive option, and you'll have trees planted in the Amazon rainforest in your honor through a verified reforestation project using native species. So if you do that, you'll get a GPS coordinates and tracking link so you can follow your trees over time. That's a great option for you as you're thinking about trees, listening to Nalini and Ed Carney today.
You know, if you're somebody who has already a lot of things, you don't need more stuff, this is the definitely the gift for you, right? No shipping, no clutter, no physical gift at all, but instead just the knowledge that you've done something powerful for UPR and for the Amazon rainforest. And again, you can get those GPS coordinates to take a look at how your tree grows and changes over time. So upr.org, that's a $20 a month donation or more that you can make and select that gift for good option and have five trees planted in the Amazon rainforest in your honor.
UPR.org, that's UPR.org, and thank you.
On the next edition of the Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll hear some intriguing collaborations that cross political, ethnic, and religious boundaries to foster peace and understanding between cultures.
You'll hear Sting with Italian singer Zucchero, Willie Nelson with Toots and the Maytals, and the Idan Reichel Project. I'm Rosalie Howard.
And I'm Dan Storper. Join us for One World, Many Cultures, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Thursday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, we look for stories that are surprising, that you won't hear anywhere else. Like, for example, this one astronaut who went to the moon. You know what he's not into? Space.
Was it cool to float around weightless?
No.
Unexpected stories every week. This American Life.
Tune in Saturday mornings at 10 here on UPR.
We're talking with Nalini Netkarni, Professor Emeritus at University of Utah and Evergreen State College, National Geographic Explorer at Large, author of Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees, and the producer and host of Tree Notes podcast on KUER, and a book associated with that. Let's talk about Tree Note. How did this come about?
Well, it really started back when I was 8 years old, when I was thinking about ways that I could protect and understand trees. But it also came out of this sort of sense of, wow, I wish more people would notice trees. And I listen to NPR, and there are two programs I was really interested in. One was Bird Note, which is this wonderful show that is produced by the Audubon Society. And it's just like a really short, like 2 minutes about a particular bird or bird-human interaction. And then Stardate is produced by the McDonald Observatory in Texas. And they have, again, just a little tiny bit of time, and they'll tell you about a planet or a star or some sort of astronomical event. So anyway, I thought, well, why don't we do that for trees? Because there's so many stories about trees that people would, I think, be very interested in listening to. So I made a little mock-up, and then I went over to KUER, and I knocked on their doors, and I said, I'd really love to do a little two-minute weekly program called Tree Note. And I gave them my little examples of, you know, of what I had put together very crudely. And they said, well, this might really be interesting to our audience. And sure enough, it has been. And so since October 21st, 2022, that's like 4 years ago, almost, every week we have been broadcasting a little two-minute bit about some aspect of tree biology or a human-tree relationship or something cool and neat about trees. And I write all the episodes. Christy Miners, who's the station manager there, is my editor. So she makes sure that it's sort of suitable for the audience and so forth. And then I record it in the studio with David Childs, who's our technical advisor there, technical person there. And they put together the music. They found a sponsor who is a local sponsor, Nate Wade Subaru, who likes to sponsor like science and environmental issues and topics. And it's just been a real joy to every week come up with some cool piece of information, some cool interaction between people and trees, to wake people up to the many ways that trees interact with people, the products we use from toothpicks to railroad ties to telephone poles, to think about how some aspect of their cool biology, like the way they can sense seasonal changes, you know, like that is amazing. They don't have eyes. They don't have data. They use, you know, sunlight and temperature to be able to make those changes. I'd like to somehow include a way that we come to understand how humans are affecting trees by deforestation or by climate change or invasive species. I also like to think about examples and present examples of how people are helping trees with tree planting or rescue operations for parrots that are fruit dispersers for the almendro tree in Costa Rica, for example. And finally, I'd like to talk about the lessons that we learned from trees, about how sort of metaphorically we can think about trees, like the body language of trees, you know, like that's kind of, oh yeah, body language of trees. What about body language of people? How do we harness and hold on to trauma in our lives, and how do we express that? So my hope is also that Tree Note serves as a way to connect us to nature because of the metaphors and the lessons that we can learn from trees.
Could I shoot a few of these topics at you and maybe have you expand a little bit? Quite a few topics, but so one of the topics was, how many kinds of trees are there?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I mean, I wonder if people in the audience could like take a guess at how many species there are. There was I'll tell you, because there was a recent scientific article 2 years ago published in the Proceedings for the National Academy of Sciences, turns out there are 73,000 species of trees that have been documented. And an estimate, they also did an estimate of the numbers of unknown species that are yet to be discovered. And there are probably another 14,000 of those, mostly in the tropics, as you might expect. But 73,000 species, to me, sounds like a heck of a lot of species. And there are over 3 trillion individuals, trees.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
I know.
Trees and lightning. This was apparently a tree gets struck by lightning, blows the bark off. That's pretty pretty violent thing. A tree
exactly.
dies, I guess, right then. But then you go on to talk about what... go ahead.
Why does lightning have that effect on trees? Why does it like just bust them open? And when you start thinking about what a tree is and how it's constructed, what we know is that it's basically a fountain, an internal fountain, right? Because trees are taking water from the soil. They're absorbing it up through the power of evaporation at their leaves. And they're basically sucking up water through their xylem, moving up as a column through the cambium all the way up to the canopy. So a tree, although the heartwood is very dry and the outside is dry, has this cylinder of water. And what happens to water when it's suddenly hit by a bolt of lightning that's really hot? What happens? Water expands when it starts boiling. And so that internal cylinder of moisture basically expands so hot, so highly, that it actually blows apart the tree.
Another one that struck my fancy, the space between trees. There's scientists, I guess, who study the space between trees. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know, when forest ecologists go out there to, and I told you one of the attributes or elements of forests is their structure, right? And we think about trees in terms of how many trees are there per acre, how big are they around the middle of them, you know, what's their circumference, what's the basal area of a forest. We think about measuring the solid things in forests. Just as we look when we walk down a city street, we say, oh, here's that building. Oh, there's the Capitol building. Oh, there's the grocery store. We look at the solid buildings. But what's also relevant in terms of the structure of a system is the empty parts, the empty spaces, the space between the solids. And that is also true in forests. So there was a researcher named Roman Dial. He's at the he's at Alaska Pacific University. And so he set out about saying, how do I study the shape and the volume of the space between trees? And he was actually a canopy researcher as well. So he strung ropes from one crown to another, and he lowered himself down through the forest at 5-meter intervals. He used a laser rangefinder, which records the distance to the next solid object. So he could go around at each of the heights where he stopped and get a measure of the distance to the nearest solid thing. And once he did that on transects throughout the forest, he was able to construct 3-dimensional maps of the empty space between trees.
Hmm.
And did this, I mean, it was so cool just to see it. You know, it was like looking at art, you know, like these amazing inverted vases and seeing the forest in like a complementary way than the normal way that you see one. But he went a step further and he started doing comparative work between different forests, like forests in Asia versus forests in Central America. And he found that the distances between trees and the volume of space in Asian forests was much larger than what you find in Central American forests. And what he also noted was that there are many more species of gliding animals that can glide from one tree crown to another in Asia than what we find in Central America. Like you can find flying squirrels in America, but there you get flying lizards and gliding snakes and all these animals that have evolved to accommodate the larger volume of empty space, because it takes energy to go down to the ground and then back up again. And so it's much more evolutionarily adaptive to be able to glide from one across a large space from one tree to another. And so that's another way of seeing a forest, is thinking about the forest, thinking about individual trees and the spaces that they create.
You have several episodes, many episodes on how we use trees, how we depend on trees. One that I thought was just fascinating. You went to you talked about the orchestra, you know, the woodwinds and other things.
That's right.
But then you focused on something I wouldn't have thought about, which is the conductor's baton. Tell me about that.
Exactly. So, you know, I was thinking, oh, well, there's like a million ways you can think about music and trees and wood. And I looked, you know, I did some studies of, you know, clarinets and marimbas and those sorts of things. But then I realized, no, the most subtle, but perhaps the most important instrument that comes from trees for an orchestra is, in fact, the conductor's baton. And I began thinking, like, are there specialized woods that are used? Do like different conductors use different trees? Do they have different feels? And so I went and interviewed Jared Oakes, who's the conductor of Ballet West here in Salt Lake City. And he was so kind and so accommodating. And he showed me all these different batons he has. And he said, now this one's made of maple and this one's made of birch and this one has a different feel. And then he also told me that he was walking along the beach in Oregon and he picked up this piece of driftwood. And he said, one day I'm going to make a baton out of this piece of driftwood that I found. And so I realized that, you know, here's this professional musician, this amazing conductor who is attuned to trees and to wood in a way that I'm not, because I'm not a musician, but that he thinks about wood and he thinks about the specific differences between different species. And he can even imagine creating a baton, you know, his instrument from a piece of wood that washed up on a beach. And so, I don't know, I think that tells me something about the universality of the appeal and the importance of trees. If the conductor of Ballet West can be like that, as well as some tree hugger who loves trees because, you know, they're out there in the wilderness. It's a beautiful connector, trees are.
Well, we could go on for another hour, I'm sure, but we're out of time here. We've been talking with Nalini Nadkarni, Professor Emeritus, University of Utah, also Evergreen State College, National Geographic Explorer at Large, author of Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connection to Trees. You can check out her TED Talks as well. She's contributed to a book for young explorers titled Kingfisher Voyages Rainforest. She's also a producer and host of Tree Note podcast on KUER, and I assume anywhere you get your podcasts, right?
Yes, indeed. Apple Radio.
Yeah. And a book based on the podcast called Tree Notes, A Year in the Company of Trees. Nalini Nadkarni, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah. Tom Williams here. Thanks so much for listening today. And it's the UPR Spring Fun Drive. I'm joined in studio by Katie Swin.
Good to be with you, Tom, on such a fun episode of the program and a great example, I think, of what Access Utah brings each weekday, Monday through Thursday, on UPR. And what a service it is to be able to learn so many new things, a service that we both believe, I think, is worth supporting and that needs your support right now during our fun drive. UPR.org is where you can go to make a gift and in support of this program, as well as any other programs that you listen to and love on UPR.
Our locally produced programs especially need our local listener support because nationally syndicated programs, This American Life, for example, is on most stations, so they're able to spread those costs over many stations. Access Utah is our program, so we can't go to Colorado Public Radio and say, hey, help support our program. They're supporting their own program. So we're coming to you and asking, can you kick in a bit of support for Access Utah? And we do have a bit of extra incentive. Leslie and Jay Black are providing a dollar-for-dollar match up to $500 today for Access Utah. So your money this hour doubled.
Just a few more minutes left to make that match. Again, up to $500, upr.org, and it happens automatically when you give in any amount. upr.org. Please donate now and have that impact further. Your money doubled, thanks to Leslie and Jay Black.
And we have a further incentive for you. If you can do $20 a month or more, you can choose our Gift for Good incentive option. This is a fun option. Trees planted in the Amazon rainforest in your honor. You get 5 trees, verified reforestation project using native species, so you receive a GPS coordinate, tracking link so you can follow your trees over time, and that's an option for you. Just click on the Gift for Good incentive.
Again, that's $20 a month to participate in the Tree Gift for Good incentive at upr.org. Tom, for decades, a small amount of, you know, listener tax dollars helped keep UPR running. But now that those tax dollars have been redirected, we're asking you to make that investment directly, which is what we're doing now. Have your donation doubled for the next couple of minutes. Maybe participate in this tree incentive and, of course, support Utah Public Radio in this new funding reality.
UPR.org, place to go, UPR.org. And thank you.